Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Charles Hughes, past president of the British Computer Society and current chair of the IFIP Professional Practice Program International Task Force. Charles, please profile your remarkable past history in the industry.
Hello, Stephen. It's an interesting start, actually. I did studied for a maths degree at Manchester University in the UK, and in those days, Manchester had a computer called Atlas, which claimed to be the biggest, most powerful computer in the world. So you couldn't do maths without getting some contact with this remarkable computer. And not knowing what to do when I left university, I decided to apply for this exciting new industry called computing in those days. Got a number of offers from big companies, IBM, English Electric, and eventually ended up joining a company called International Computers and Tabulators, ICT, which very quickly in 1968 became ICL. I had planned to stay there for 2 years because they had a superb graduate training program, and ended up staying there for 32 years. And during that time, I guess one of the constant themes of my career was sales and marketing, from the very early days, all the way through to several director level positions. But I also ran business centers. We were developing advanced graphic workstations. I was responsible for ICL's defense business, which came to mind recently because it was 25 years ago at the time of the Falklands War, which was an exciting time. And I was also variously ICL's technical director and also spent a couple of years as purchasing director, which was great fun for a guy with a strong sales and marketing background. During that time also I served on the main boards of IT companies in the United States, the United Kingdom, Australia, and Germany. The German one was quite interesting. I was chairman of the board of the European Computer Research Center, which was based in Munich, and it was jointly owned by Siemens from Germany, Bull from France, and ICL from the United Kingdom. And the essence of the company, with about 100 staff, was that it was international, absolutely international. So there were employees from 35 different nationalities. And I recollect the basis of the company was an agreement, an off-the-record agreement between the three owners, that the company would be based in Germany, the language of the company would be English, and the French would have the recommendation of managing director. But it worked extraordinarily well for a number of years. I also, during the 1990s, spent 2.5 years working for Her Majesty's government in the UK in the Department of Trade and Industry. I was invited to go and join them for a couple of years. This is 1995, and this sort of 12 years later sounds rather peculiar, but they needed some help working out the answers to two questions. The first was, is the internet going to have any impact on business? And if so, is there anything that the government should be doing about it? Fortunately, as you will guess, we came up with the answers yes and yes, and I spent 2 years as the project director and program director for the Information Society Initiative, which was the first major British government program to help businesses understand the implications of the rapid development of the internet and World Wide Web, which in 1995, neither of which were very well known. And after that, I formed my own company in 1999, eManagement Limited.
So that's quite a remarkable history, as I indicated, in essence, you've been somewhat of a pioneer in terms of some of the innovations that have occurred in the marketplace and being sort of an early recognizer of those innovations and getting involved.
Yes, I had the privilege of, I mentioned the advanced graphic workstation business I was running. I set up the first Unix compiler team in the UK. I also had under my wing a team developing array processors, distributed array processors, and I've had the privilege of being involved in a number of developments over those past 40 years now. I'm celebrating later this year my 40th anniversary of being in the IT industry.
How are you continuing to contribute and using your sort of past history successes with your current company, eManagement Limited?
eManagement works on an advisory and consultation role in several different guises. One is concerned with program and project advisory roles, and in that sort of guise, I have worked for the British government, particularly on a large pan-government program that involved several different government departments, a number of research councils, health and safety agencies, National Health Service and others, which was looking at biotechnology and the development of biotechnology, and particularly the very difficult problem of how people in the biotechnology industry can access the raft of information that's available, sometimes of an advisory nature, sometimes of a regulatory nature, when they are working on biotechnology projects. That, in fact, I started off as advisor and became chairman of the project board, which consisted of representatives from all these different government departments. And as you can imagine, the policy discussions we had from different perspectives were really quite fascinating and insightful. Pleased to say we won a couple of major British awards for that program. I've also been working with an IT agency, staff agency, working with the owner and chief executive of that company for some 4 years now, advising and guiding them in the business environment and the development of the company, Outsource UK, which is going very successfully. In fact, we've just completed the successful takeover of another company. I also specialise in working on the interface between the private sector, particularly the IT supply side, and central government. Having worked in both, it became very obvious that they are very different worlds, and often they ignore each other or don't recognize what it is that the other does and the strength of the other. And in fact, of course, they are totally dependent, mutually dependent. They have different drivers. They speak different languages. Their understandings, their policy-making methodologies differ substantially. And often it's difficult for them to communicate successfully. So I've been helping both on the government side. I worked for Her Majesty's Treasury for a while, and also on the supply side with companies like BT, Charteris, Mantix, and in the latter two cases, helping them set up practices, public sector practices within their businesses. And also, of course, I work on professionalism and the development of professionalism in our IT industry on a very broad base. And that complements my role last year as president of the British Computer Society, which professionalism in IT was my major thread and the big program that the BCS is leading with.
You know, you're doing so much with e-management, and as a result, you're going to be deriving a lot of lessons. Can you share with us three stories that would be a benefit to business and IT leaders?
I think the first one I've sort of touched on, a recognition that public and private sectors are different. So often I found people who, when I returned from working for central government to the industry, you know, a lot of people said, what's it like being back in the real world? Obviously implying that the government sphere at politics is not the real world, and it certainly is a very different world, but it's absolutely real, and the impacts that the public sector and government have on the IT industry are absolutely fundamental. And so often we see in a number of areas the public sector making, I think, often ill-informed decisions about the industry because often of this lack of communication and understanding between the two. So I think that they are both very real worlds. I'm very keen to engender better relationships, more communication, more joint working between the two, because I'm certain that the more that the public sector and the private sector, the IT industry, work together, the better for both. And the better judgments that one gets in terms of policy decisions, regulation, and indeed in some cases legislation. So that would be one. I think the other one that comes to mind, probably at the top of the head, is that running one's own company, and I also do a lot of work on the voluntary front with the British Computer Society, and indeed the Information Technologists Company, which is the 100th livery company of the City of London. And the livery company is involved with educational work, charitable works, development of the industry. And it's really, really nice in all these environments to be working with people that you trust and respect. And I think that one of my lessons of life is that whenever possible, I choose to work with people I trust and respect. You make such more progress, and life is altogether more successful and significantly happier than the alternatives.
So it sounds like one of your key lessons is also about relationships and being a bridge.
Yes, it would be indeed. Helping facilitate, helping signpost, helping people communicate and work together. Absolutely.
You know, you're doing so much work with this UNESCO-founded body called the International Federation of Information Processing, and you also chair the task force. Can you tell us more about IFIP, the task force, and what you're trying to do with this program, this professional practice program?
Yeah, I would be delighted to. Can I start by just painting the outline of what the British Computer Society has been doing over the past years, which has formed the foundation and I think along with the work that Kipps has been doing and others, form the basis of the task force. Because if you go back to 2003, which is when the BCS started looking at professionalism in IT, there were a number of issues. There were major concerns about the industry and the way it tackled problems. We've even recently had Gartner announcing that 74% of projects, IT projects, exceed budget or schedule or fail in some guise or other. And they further comment that that is the same percentage that they measured 25 years ago in 1980. That is not good. We had a report from the Royal Academy of Engineering here in the UK and the British Computer Society. They looked at projects and concluded that there was a huge chasm between common practice in IT and best practice in IT. I worked with the trade association in the UK, Intellect, a few years ago, looking at the reasons why projects fail, and we researched all the history, all the published documentation, and found 16 major reasons why projects fail. And they weren't new. These were not new reasons. They were understood. We know that these things happen. And it would appear that we continue to repeat the same issues. We make the same mistakes that we've made before. That's not professional. And indeed, an article in the Times a short while ago referenced this report from the Royal Academy and the BCS and said, in other words, the IT industry is sloppy. Now, I think that's a charge that we need to counteract. I think there's some truth in that charge, but it's one that they ought not to be able to level at us. And if you look at the essence of professionalism, it is, in my view, threefold. It's people having the right competencies for the job, the right technical competencies, the right knowledge, the right skills, and, of course, the right experience to demonstrate that they can put the theory into practice. But it's not just those technical skills. It's also the softer skills. It's the interpersonal relationships. It's the ability to communicate. It's the management and leadership skills and capabilities. I was surprised that a professor of computer science pointed out to me, she said that at our university, computer science is the only degree a graduate can get that throughout the whole of the course, they need not talk to another living soul. I'm not suggesting that many do, but we can't afford not to be able to communicate what we do and to put that into context and to carry people with us. Secondly, professionalism means taking on board a significant degree of personal commitment and obligation. It means that you've got to recognize that the decisions you take are yours and yours alone. My boss told me to do it, the excuse, that's what the contract said, we were running out of time, so we cut software testing. These are not acceptable, and indeed in many countries, not acceptable in court. The decision of what to do for a professional is a professional judgment based on his or her knowledge and experience, and the professional needs to live with the decisions they take. Thirdly, a recognition that professionalism is about a commitment to society. It's an undertaking that professionals will work in the best interests of society, for the public good. And this encompasses a wide range of, at one extreme, being willing and able to explain what one's doing in terms that people can understand and to discuss and debate. Secondly, being able to advise people about the implications. I mean, we are now more and more, day by day, into IT and communication systems, which have huge implications and huge impingements into everyday life. There are often outcomes that are not well predicted. There are turns of the wheel. And we really ought to be very much in the driving seat of explaining to people what is happening, why, what the risks are, what the opportunities are, so that people are in a better informed position to make sound judgments. So it's those three things I see making up professionalism. I rather liked the definition that Justice Sandra Day O'Connor gave. She's recently stood down from the U.S. Supreme Court, and her definition of professionalism, which I think encompasses all my three legs of the stool, is the essence of professionalism is a commitment to develop one's skills to the fullest and to apply them responsibly to the problems at hand. Professionalism requires adherence to the highest ethical standards of conduct and a willingness to subordinate narrow self-interest in the pursuit of the more fundamental goal of public service.
So how does that expand then in terms of, sort of there was some early leadership from the British Computer Society in terms of meeting the challenges within your region, and then taking that to sort of an international federation. Can you describe what happened there and where it's building towards?
So the BCS set off down the path of putting professionalism and IT as its most important strategic program. They invested a significant amount of resource and time in it, and indeed that continues. The recognition is, of course, immediate that we live in a global village. Our profession, more than many others indeed, is international. We do need to have an international perspective. And we were delighted to be invited to present a keynote address to the World Computer Congress that IFIP run. That was in August last year. And as a result of that and a workshop that was organized in parallel with the conference, IFIP Council took the decision that running an international program on professionalism in IT would be beneficial for individuals, practitioners, suppliers, and all the potential users of our IT systems. And we were absolutely delighted that they invited the Canadian Computer Society, the Australian Computer Society, BCS, and the South Africans to set up this task force. They invited me to chair the task force to look at whether it would be feasible and advisable to launch an international program on professionalism in IT. We met in January. We submitted a report to the Council of IFIP, and it was unequivocal and absolutely unanimous in its decision that there would be a lot of benefit for many in running such a program. That report was considered at IFIP's council meeting in March, and they approved the launch of an international program, and we're all now working kits at BCS, ACS. At the last meeting, as well as the South Africans, we were also pleased to welcome the IEEECS, and we are heading to work out a major international program to raise the level of professionalism in IT. This, of course, will bring many benefits. The whole purpose of this is not self-aggrandizement of IT people. It is very much to deliver bottom-line value. And we're looking here for a set of developments which will give greater confidence in the delivery of projects and programs. We are looking for a better return on investment. We are looking for higher benefits realization for projects and IT-enabled programs. We're looking for IT practitioners to be more highly regarded. One would anticipate those with the highest skills and highest professional qualifications would command higher rewards. They would have more interesting, wide-ranging jobs, and we would anticipate from the collective of this that the end users, the customers, the consumers of the systems we implement would also derive immediate benefits in terms of the delivery of the services that they look for. So a major program we have launched. We are underway with that program. The first milestone we have is to report back to IFIP's General Assembly in August this year, and that will be with a set of objectives and a clear business plan for the program. I'm delighted that we already have some seedcorn funding provided by IFIP, by KIPS, by BCS and ACS. So we've got some money to get going over the next 6 months. The program itself needs to be a high-profile program. We need to develop over the next 18 months the standards, the benchmarks, the measures for an international positioning of professionalism in IT. We can do that based on some primary research, but drawing significantly from the excellent work that's already been done, particularly in Australia, Canada, and the UK. And we need then to have a parallel communications media engagement program and a program to involve all the member societies of IFIP and to enlist the involvement of IT practitioners. To do all of that requires significant resources, and we are actively now seeking support from sponsors to help us put this program in place and to help us communicate the benefits and to raise the level of professionalism in IT.
So it's clear then that the outcomes will have a significant impact on industry and business and government and education within the media, within IT professionals themselves and the IT, ICT profession. So it's a significant body of work, and I can see that it's a major commitment for you personally.
Yes, it is. We think that the industry has just about reached a stage of maturity where a program like this really can gain a lot of traction. Attempts have been made before in our earlier days, and if roughly you say that as an industry we've been going 50 years, then never really been able to gel, and it's certainly never been looked at from an international perspective. The BCS did some research looking at other professions, health, legal, accountancy, one or two of the newer ones like marketing and HR, and looked at how they had developed, and indeed some of them have developed over a long period of time, where they are, the sorts of capabilities the profession has, the responsibilities it carries, and the role of the individual practitioners. It was interesting, you know, somebody said to me, how often when you go and see your doctor do you get them to sign a TLA, a non-disclosure, an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement? And of course you don't, you know, you assume that it is going to be kept confidential. And we need to make a lot of progress. So we're working down that path. We think that there are great things to be achieved, and we think that there is sufficient maturity in the industry that we can move ahead very rapidly. We did a measure, a sort of five-stage measure of success, of development of professional institutions, and if you regard step five as being a fully formed, fully operational professional organization, a professional institution, a profession, then at the moment the IT industry is on step two. So the good news is that we've made progress over those 50 years. The opportunity is that we've got quite a long way to go yet, and a program like this we believe can move us ahead very rapidly and start delivering some of the significant benefits much earlier than would otherwise be the case.
Charles, what are critical issues facing organizations today, and how can they be addressed? And how does this extend to sort of leadership lessons that are essential for business and technology executives?
It's an area we've been also looking carefully at. I'd like to draw here on steering board that BCS put in place with the Chartered Management Institute, Change Leadership Network, some 18 months ago, looking at how one can use IT for business change, IT-enabled business change. We were taking the view that if we just look at the IT practitioners, the IT industry, then that's rather introverted. There is at chief executive, at COO level, quite clearly a whole raft of balancing acts, of information, of skills that one needs to make sure that these significant investments in IT communications are used to best effect. Often the case these days that the technology is pretty robust. Yeah, I mean, there are scalability problems, there are issues on the leading edge and so on and so forth, but broadly these days the technology is pretty robust. And therefore the issues that we have with projects and programs not delivering their benefits are often concerned with much broader aspects. And we looked and came up with five specific areas of, we believe, key interest and activity for chief executives and COOs and other senior managers. I include permanent secretaries, I include government ministers in this. And the first is that what we're doing here is creating transformational value. We are using IT as a tool to deliver change, to deliver benefit, to deliver new services and systems. We are not just implementing IT projects. And I think one of the biggest failures that we have is the view that many hold that the task is to implement an IT project. And you can end up with a silly situation where the IT project team has a major party to celebrate the tremendous success of the technological hardware, software services that they've just implemented, all available on time, all whizzing and working wonderfully, and delivering no business benefit at all. That is not an acceptable situation. And the answer has got to be twofold. It's got to be within the IT profession a genuine recognition and genuine understanding of the business environment, of the business drivers, and how information and communication technologies can help achieve those. But also it's got to be recognized and managed, led from very senior positions. We need to create the strategic context. There has to be a clear vision which needs to be articulated, and that guidance and management of the scope of the initiative are the only ways to bring about clear benefits, as well as making sure that these people allocate the time to lead from the front. That also, of course, must recognize that there will be resistance. The moment we start looking at significant change, then there is always resistance of some ilk, and that needs to be managed, needs to be handled, and we need to develop shared understandings through clear communications of the opportunities and the risks. That itself also requires clear implementation and governance mechanisms for the information systems and the IT, and that's got to include planning the testing of those systems and also implementing the behavioural changes and ensuring those changes are realised. You know, this is not quite exclusively, but almost all of this is to do with management of the organisation and the management of the people. So that's one, creating transformational value rather than just implementing IT projects. My second one would be building the capability for ongoing change. We cannot afford to look at projects as one-offs. They need to be regarded as part of a transformation portfolio. The chief executive must be in the driving seat of managing the portfolio so that they can see a single picture of all the change initiatives. They can do the clarification and the balancing and scale of resources across the various projects and programs. And they must be in a position to ensure the efficiency gains in change management. That also puts very firmly at the CEO's door the understanding of the effects of the decisions taken in one project on what's happening elsewhere, and where appropriate, the need to challenge the strategic relevance of specific projects, and never to be afraid of killing off projects which are wayward, which are not making the contribution that they were anticipated to make. So that prioritisation of the importance and value of the particular projects, those priorities changing over time, and the tracking of the performance and progress and the interrelationships between those of that overall portfolio will be number two. So building a capability for ongoing change, recognising that this is not a one-off, this is now absolutely a continuous capability that is needed in any organisation, in any enterprise. Thirdly, and I think it's probably already inherent in what I've said, is creating a climate of open communication. Any significant organisation, the lifeblood of successful large-scale IT-enabled change programmes, is effective communication. Too often we hear that what was implemented was not what was required. We hear that everything would have been fine if the customers hadn't changed their mind and changed the requirement spec. And we often find at the basis of many issues is a lack of or poor level of communication. And of course, if you find technologists buried and inured in the technology, talking to senior managers, then one can sometimes see that they're not necessarily on the same planet. But we need formal and informal lateral communications, very powerful in shaping attitudes, and downward and upward communication mechanisms, so that, you know, when things are going well or if things are not going so well, there are measures and communication paths that don't hide the problems. So that would be my third, creating a climate of open communication. The fourth responsibility I'd put at the door of senior management is managing the confidence and the risk. We are always involved in a degree of risk. There are rapid changes in technology. Some programs will be fairly quick and minor to implement. Others will take several years. Others will have significant risk profiles associated with them. And experience in managing that successful change and understanding the balance of the risks and the opportunities is important, as well as setting the expectations of the individuals who are doing the implementation, the individuals who are going to be directly affected by it, and understanding their fears and concerns and helping them develop those and the understanding, and so that the benefits realisation genuinely does come to pass, whether one's working in a greenfield site or a brownfield site, the programme is coming to fruition. So those would be my four thoughts for senior management, looking at the whole area of IT-enabled business change.
Well, that's quite an interesting list, and I can clearly see that the integration of IT with business and the alignment of IT with business is critical to all of this, and it cannot be treated as a separate silo, so to speak, or as a maintenance function.
Indeed, it can't. It has to be an absolute integral part of the business, and progressively more so, which not only requires IT practitioners and IT departments to recognize that, but it also requires chief executives and other senior managers to recognize that, you know, they cannot just put the totality of the responsibility on the shoulders of the IT director or CIO. You know, if it's something to do with computers, you can't abrogate responsibility. You need to play your rightful role in making sure the totality of the programs and portfolios are successful.
Charles, what are the biggest issues facing user group communities, IT societies today, and what are your recommendations for meeting these challenges?
I think, Stephen, there are several issues. My own personal view is that user societies, professional institutions, have got in our industry an even bigger role to play today than they have ever had. I think the IT industry has always had a very strong interest in the engineering computer science end, who have always been the conference circuits, the seminars, the institutions involved in that research academic computer science area. I think of paramount importance today is the recognition that IT practitioners are themselves professionals, the people who use the technology to turn it into applications, the people who use IT communications technologies to deliver benefits, to offer services to end users, to customers. Those people really do need to recognize that we have an industry here which is fundamental to everything else. It is very difficult to think of any activity, health, transport, finance, government, industry, commerce, that doesn't almost inevitably depend already on the products and services that our industry has implemented. That gives us a tremendous responsibility. And professional institutions have got a major role to play, obviously, in developing the professionalism of the industry, of those practitioners, and the BCS Chartered IT Professional Standard is one which we regard as the gold standard for IT practitioners. In Canada, KIPS has got ISP, which is of similar standing. And those are important, but part of the overall professionalism drive, part of the need to offer help and services to members, to offer to the industry a balanced, neutral view of the implications of IT. It's very hard to think of any other organisation that can offer an expert, neutral view. And part and parcel of our responsibilities are to do that on behalf of the public and society at large. As far as the BCS is concerned, that's embedded in our Royal Charter. BCS has been going through a major transformation program of its own over the past 5 years with the introduction of Chartered IT Professional, with a new governance structure. We changed the Royal Charter, the bylaws, the regulations, very much more positioning the society in the 21st century, very much looking to be a learned society as we've always been, but also a professional institution recognising and serving the needs of those IT practitioners, the people working in the business. And now for 2.5 years since these changes came about, membership has been, we've been signing up over 1,000 new members a month in gross terms, which is very heartening. And I think that recognition that professional institutions, user groups, the ability to meet with one's peers, discuss issues, seminars, communications, education, training, but also that support, that sucker, that definition of the standards of professionalism, that neutral perspective and that ability to say out loud to the world when things are going right or when they're not going so right, this is the view, is vitally important. And I would like to see many more institutions following that path and developing in that way.
Charles, you know, the world is sort of remarkable position today. It's a very dynamic environment. Would you care to give some predictions about the future of IT or business trends and their implications and opportunities?
One or two feelers. Let's first of all start off with the technology. I'm of the view that despite all stories to the contrary, the rate of change and development of technology, whether it be hardware, software, whatever it may be in our arena, is moving even faster than it has ever done before. The concept that everything in IT has already been done, that the industry is boring, I absolutely and totally refute. I think it is exciting, it is demanding, and there will be a constant supply of new ideas, new concepts, and new technologies for the IT practitioners to pick up and implement. And we are going to see fundamental changes. We have seen the World Wide Web. I mean, I mentioned, you know, 1995, nobody I spoke to knew what the World Wide Web was, one or two exceptions. Did anybody have email addresses on their business cards? No, they didn't. I used to ask audiences of IT people. And the rate of change over those 12 years, Tim Berners-Lee put the World Wide Web into the public domain in 1992, and the transformation over 15 years has been phenomenal. We've now got Web 2 coming along. We have got all sorts of other technologies and capabilities, not to mention things like quantum computing, maybe some way down the road yet, but certainly quantum key distribution is with us today and is operational in North America and in the UK and other parts of the world. There are all sorts of wonderful technological developments and changes which will give us huge opportunities for the future. And we need to be able to use those carefully and beneficially for the well-being of society. Second one, I think I would look to the continuation of the globalization. Thinking in this context significantly of offshoring. There's been a lot of discussion in the UK and elsewhere about the benefits or otherwise of offshoring, of moving work geographically away from one nation to other nations. And we've got offshoring to the Indian subcontinent, to China, indeed India offshores to some things to China and South America. The whole area is one of significant discussion and debate, and I think I would be very concerned if there were any very vehement protectionist views being expressed. I see this as a natural and normal development. It is our industry that has created the capability for this to happen, and it would be naive in the extreme if we as an industry endeavoured to turn our backs on this. I suspect we can't. I think already, you know, the pendulum has swung so far. I recollect in the days when outsourcing was first in the early 1990s on the map, people used to ask me, should we consider outsourcing? And my immediate response was absolutely. Not necessarily to do it, but you must consider it, because the view was, without any exception, that people who went through the process of looking at how they could or should outsource some of their activities found ways of improving their own processes and procedures, ways of changing their practices and developing their businesses for the better. Whether or not, at the end of the day, they actually went ahead and did some outsourcing. And I think that we are now very much in a steep learning curve as to what it is possible to do at arm's length. We have got the Follow the Sun programs that many big corporations run. We have got the development of exceptional capability in some areas of India and China in terms of intellect and brain power, and it is not just going to be the mundane call centre jobs that are offshored, but a whole range of possibilities opening up. And I think, you know, we all need to treat this with an understanding, with a capability and professional eye that does the best for our industry and for society at large.
Well, Charles, we thank you for sharing your time with us, and we wish you continued success for the future. You've provided us many deep insights into technology and business and professionalism and societies and where things are building out for the future. And it's those insights that our audience will find of great value. So thank you again.
Stephen, my great pleasure. Thank you very much for the opportunity.